your thoughts, your reaction, what quickly comes to mind in reaction to the word wilderness. What does it conjure up?
Big trees.
Untouched beauty.
Untouched beauty.
No motorbikes.
No motorbikes.
Cars or homes or development.
Fresh air.
Politics.
Pardon?
Politics.
Yeah. But let me take you out of the context of legal wilderness, which we're going to talk about, and that's politics. But just wilderness. Just the word. Okay.
Bears.
Bears?
Well, to me, it's sort of like an approach avoidance conflict. You thoroughly enjoy it, but you're somewhat fearful of it because there's something there that could be harmful.
Okay, fear. It's interesting. One of the first retreats we did, the young man I was working with then used a lot of passages from the Bible, many of which were not familiar to me. In the many different ways wilderness was used in the Bible. And one was to connote fear, but another one, of course, you can find many examples where Christ used wilderness as a place of meditation. And that's a word that often comes up when I ask this question. Solitude is an important one because it became a legal attribute of wilderness. But an opportunity for solitude. Anything else? Is important to you. How many people here go to wilderness? I don't necessarily mean legal classified wilderness, but to wild places. Okay. How many have lived there? Backpack. How long a time? What's the longest time any of you have spent in wilderness?
You specify that I thought people couldn't live in the wilderness, so.
Well, overnight is living for me.
Three. Two nights.
Two nights.
Week.
Week. That's long now. Very few people take week trips. Anybody longer than that?
2 months.
2 months.
3 months.
3 months. Good. Well, I pursue that for just a minute because I want you to realize that this isn't about extended backpacking. It isn't about necessarily legal wilderness, so we will talk about that because it's a wonderful treasure that we've created for ourselves in this country, and you should be aware of that, and it's yours to use. But more than that, we're talking about wild places. One of the definitions I heard is at least in a parallel phrase, is just unfettered nature, nature that we haven't changed, haven't affected significantly or altered by our action, ecosystems that are essentially intact as they were before we came. And you can find those an awful lot of places besides in the big wildernesses like the Glacier Peak that surrounds us. Before we go any farther with this, I'd like to share really a gift to you that I helped create in 1984 to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Wilderness Act. A wonderfully creative young man that works on the Mount Hood Forest did all of the technology. But it's a slide program, and I've got a videotape of the Lapse Dissolve slide program. It takes 6 projectors and all kinds of electronics and an enormous screen. We used a screen the size of this building when we first showed it in Portland to Wilderness Society and Forest Service, Park Service, all of us celebrating the 25th anniversary. About 85% of the photo material is mine over my career, and I want to share that with you. Partly because it's a wonderful mood setter for us, but also through the soundtrack are short and important passages of the many people that have thought about what wilderness means. And it also gives the legal definitions from the Act in the beginning of what we created in 1964. And I think it'll certainly set the mood for being in beautiful places. Some of the words you've already heard. Interestingly, the first night, Vespers, we heard John Muir quoted with the same passage that's in this film. Last night, Scott quoted the now famous words of Chief Seattle. They're also in this soundtrack. So let's look at that, and then we will begin to move into personal meanings of wilderness and the connectedness that I want to share with you and I want you to share with me. So what I would like you to do is jump up, because this is hard for me to do, because a video of this is just such a pale representation of what it should be when it's done with a multi-slide projector. So just move yourselves over here and get fairly close to those TV sets, because they are essentially large landscapes, and from a distance you just don't get a feel for them.
Accompanied by expanding settlement and growing mechanization, does not occupy and modify all areas within the United States and its possessions, leaving no lands designated for preservation and protection in their natural condition. It is hereby declared to be the policy of the Congress to secure for the American people of present and future generations the benefits of an enduring resource of wilderness. For this purpose, there is hereby established a national wilderness preservation system to be composed of federally owned areas designated by Congress as wilderness areas. And these shall be administered for the use and enjoyment of the American people in such a manner as will leave them unimpaired for future use and enjoyment as wilderness. A wilderness, in contrast with those areas where man and his works dominate the landscape, is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. Claim upon men's hearts. as for the subtle scent, that quality of the air, that emanation from the old trees, that so wonderfully changes and renews the weary spirit. It is the great moral spa. It is the best place in the world to bring an old sorrow that has been a long while your friend and enemy. With every hour you change, the air penetrates through your clothes and nestles to your living body. You forget all your scruples and live a while in peace and freedom, and for the moment only. nature's peace will flow into you as sunshine flows into trees. The winds will blow their freshness into you and the storms their energy, while cares will drop off like autumn leaves.
Thank you.
I think the most important message that holds and what we tried to capture is that the wilderness is more than landscapes. That's why the flowers and the little frogs, and it's all that's there. And probably the words of Aldo Leopold in the soundtrack are the most important. And he makes that point that it is the connectedness and the integrity of the whole that makes any wilderness wilderness. And that's why the very strict criteria for the admission of lands to the wilderness system. Let me read one more passage from another Native American. Black Elk, the medicine man of the Ogallala Sioux, who's written extensively or has been recorded extensively, said these words: "The first piece, which is the most important, is that which comes within the souls of the people when they realize their relationship, their oneness with the universe and all its powers. And when they realize that at the center of the universe dwells a great spirit, and that this center is really everywhere, it is within each of us." Interestingly, Leopold paraphrased that, if you listen carefully, because he included humans. And of course, he was a biologist, and not all biologists I've associated with, excuse me, yes, he was a biologist, a wildlife biologist in his case, but not all wildlife biologists I've associated with in my career seem to recognize humans as a part of the equation. In fact, they're out there trying to save all the creatures, and the creatures do very well without us. It's only when we acknowledge our relationship to them that all this works. But Black Elk understood it. Native Americans understood it because they had to understand it to survive. They had to coexist within the natural world that provided them life and sustenance and spiritual help. And so the American Indian is much quoted and often misquoted in this search that we all seem to be making for spiritual meaning in nature and giving definition to it. And you'll see lots of that. But many other societies in the world now are emerging in their relationships with nature as a guide for us to begin to acknowledge that we are just as codependent on our environment as so-called primitive peoples were. And there was some talk about that last night from Scott. There's a big question in my mind of who's primitive. Let me share some personal relationships just briefly, so you know perhaps a little bit more about me and what caused me to, one, pursue the life I did, and secondly, you know, how my spiritual interdependence with natural places all came about. I was born on a farm in Iowa of German parentage, and my dad lost the farm in the Depression, and we came out west so he could support us, and got a job in the shipyards in the war years. And we had very little money, but we had a very close family, just my sister and myself and father and mother. And no car. And so I was dependent on a bicycle or the Greyhound bus to get out to the Columbia Gorge from Portland and find wild places. And I did that. And essentially alone from about the time I was, I guess, 8 years old, occasionally with my family, but if I lived there, that means overnight and longer, then it was usually solitary. What I learned early, and I'd been taught early on, is self-dependence, managing risk, which is I think an essential to growing up. Learning to manage risk, and of course, to manage risk, you have to place yourself at risk. You can do that quite easily in nature. And if you don't manage the risk, it's very unforgiving. But it's not an unfriendly place. Wild places are not a place of fear. If you learn to see, and we'll do that in our hour after coffee, we'll talk about how to perceive. But the other thing I learned very young, because I was alone, was really self-contemplation, would be the best way to say it. And I learned to observe. I didn't have anything else to do, anybody to talk to. And I remember most particularly the, I've had so many dramatic experiences in nature and memorable experiences, but the one that still is probably the most so was the one that really taught me to continue to see and see more clearly and to learn patience. And you know, when you're 8, 9, 10 years old, you're not real patient and you're into adventure. But I decided one morning when I got up to climb into a, I hadn't seen many animals. And that disappointed me. And I was as far from the back in the mountains as I'd ever been. I was at Wadham Lake up the Eagle Creek in the Columbia River Gorge. And it was a beautiful misty morning, and I climbed up into the crotch of a big old big leaf maple and just hunkered down in the licorice ferns and that grow there and waited to see what would come to water as the sun came up. And I was rewarded by the usual and then the unusual. And the unusual was a fox that came down to the edge of the water and studied his surroundings. And he reached down and he picked up a driftwood stick from that had drifted away from the beaver dams and took it in his muzzle and started almost imperceptibly to move out into the lake in the shallow sand portion of the lake. And just slowly, inch by inch, and slowly the water was rising around him. Of course, I was really puzzled at what he was up to. And, you know, because of the stick, I knew he wasn't hunting anything. And so finally, he was nothing but his head was above the water, and he started to I was going to say dog paddle, fox paddle. And so he starts paddling around, and then slowly, and then I realized, and his whole muzzle was covered with lice and vermin, and he was getting rid of them. And of course, if you've ever watched a petter, you know what they do, they just hunker down. And so he had figured all this out. He just went out there slow enough, they moved ahead of the water. They went out on the stick, he submerged, and got rid of most of them. So, you know, clever like a fox, yeah. But what a reward, you know, for a young boy to be given. What a gift to be given. And so I learned then that if I wanted to see the creatures, then I had to be like the creatures, and I had to be quiet, which for me is a great chore, and to observe and to understand. We'll talk more later about talking to the animals, which is okay. They won't lock you up. That became an extension of my life, and I went overseas. I was in Europe in the mountain training center and lived in the Alps for a while. But I came home, and I knew from the early beginnings and my storytelling grandfather, who had come over from Germany to flee the political system and homestead in the United States. And he had homesteaded at one time in Mount Angel, Oregon. It was a German community, and tried to get my grandma to join him, but she was pregnant with her fifth child, and she says, you get back here to the farm in Iowa. So Gramps left Oregon, but always dreamed of being there because it reminded him of his boyhood in the Black Forest in Germany. And his father was a Forstmeister. And so he filled me with all these dreams. And then when I was going to Oregon, I mean, I was going to heaven because of my grandfather's influence, and I knew darn well I wanted to be a Forstmeister, a forester. Didn't know what they were or what they did, but I sure wanted to be one. And so there was no question in my mind what my career was going to be. I came back from the Army, met my wife almost by accident, or the woman that was to become my wife, and she had lived in Chicago, in St. Louis, in Louisville. My father was in electrical construction, moved all over the country, always in urban settings, born in Kansas. Had never been hiking, never been backpacking. But she had an awful lot to give me, as good marriages always prove. And she understood a lot of the values of music and art and other cultural things that I had no appreciation for. So in our year and a half of courtship, we blended those two, and she learned to be an expert fly fisher person. By the way, gender-specific language, and that is in the laws of the United States. It wasn't mine. same drill with the good chief. So you can't blame me for that. But she became a very expert fly fisher person, loved it. We made some pretty arduous hikes for someone who never hiked before, but didn't camp overnight until we got married. And we spent our honeymoon in the wilderness. And her first experience in sleeping in a sleeping bag was on our honeymoon. And that was in what was to become the Mount Jefferson Wilderness. We got married on September 3rd, 1956. And we spent all of our anniversaries in wilderness. And it was in, we were in the Goat Rocks wild area at the time, classified by the Forest Service. On September 3rd, 1964, 8 years later, they signed the Wilderness Act. So I was really appreciative of the Congress that decided to use that, our wedding anniversary, to sign the Wilderness Act. It's also a real value to me because that way I never forget my anniversary. But so life's little coincidences. So we were able to celebrate the creation of the wilderness system, which I had worked for those 8 years on the politics of, as you correctly say, it is political. To get a wilderness system, we were able to celebrate on our anniversary in what had become wilderness. That takes us to family and how it built for us, and I know it has for many people that have shared with me, what a real dandy place it is to raise children. To teach self-reliance, to teach discovery, to learn from the children, to wonder, because we forget how to wonder as we grow older. And children always, if we're patient and we listen to them and we're affected by them and we never tire of the questions that come and come and come, and many times we don't know the answers to, and so we discover them together. So there is no, in my mind, no better place to raise children than in wild places and to share with them. I thought all of my sensing of wilderness, either seeing, smelling, touching, feeling, was very acute, but it became far more acute when I shared it with my children. And so that really became our family community spiritual place, our church, our cathedral. We made very regular backpack trips all throughout their growing years. In the Busher family, there really was no word for vacation because we never went on one. We never went to Disneyland. It would never have occurred to us, because we had this wonderful privilege that my work took me to those places and they worked with me. They came with me. And so that really became our place of worship, and built a real understanding, I think, for all of us that creation is the gift of God and we are a part of that creation. The self-reliance one, I want to tell you a little story. We did this gradually. I see so many people that take their children to wilderness, so many fathers, I'll be very gender specific, so many fathers that make it a macho trip and over-challenge, set too elaborate goals in distance and in height, and they become forced marches, and many families get turned off by all this. Children lose their freedom. They have too many obligations. It shouldn't be that way. But it is a wonderful place to teach increasing responsibility. And so that's how we did it. But we always paced ourselves to the children's needs. And as they grew, they outgrew our needs. My son could walk faster and farther than I could when they finally left home. And so we grew together. And I remember one particular place, and it happens to be where that last slide with the wind-blown tree is. That's one of our favorite camps on the side of Mount Hood. We were on a working trip. We were locating part of the Crest Trail. That's, the family was working with me. So we went to find a high camp well away from the trail system and people. And so my son and I went ahead, and my wife and daughter were down filling the water bottles, because we always camp at dry camp, so we're never near people. So they were filling the water bottles, and he and I scampered up this slope, and I told him to be really conscious of the route we were taking, because of course we were way off trail. And we found this high camp, and I said, okay, you go back and guide the girls in. So old Mark, who was, I think, 7 years old, he went down the mountain, and he found them and started leading them up. And about halfway up, he began to lose his confidence that he was on the right path. And I mean, we were in an enormous landscape, and he'd lost his sense of where I had set the camp. And he sat down on a rock, and he turned to my wife, Jean, and he says, I just can't stand all this responsibility. So, or like the time we were coming out of the Go Rocks, and my daughter, who was then 9 years old, she knew we were in elk country. We'd seen a lot of elk signs. She says, how will I know if I'm close to an elk? And we were in heavy young timber and heading out, and so we were making pretty good time. Been in for 8 days. And she said, how will I know if I'm close to an elk? Because we hadn't seen one yet. I said, you'll smell them. I said, what do they smell like? Well, they smell like a barnyard. Oh. And about 10 paces down the trail, this huge eruption in the brush, and a cow elk had been bedded down right next to the trail, and she leaps to her feet, takes one hop on the trail, and sails off down the mountain into the Packwood Glacier. And you know, I'm startled. My daughter turns around and says calmly to me, she says, you're right, they do smell like a barnyard. So you build those really wonderful human experiences that you keep. It builds strength. Spiritual relationships then of ourselves to nature. A place for inward reflection. We'll talk lots about that and have an opportunity this afternoon. Humility, the awe of creation. It's very, very hard to be pompous in the mountains. Very hard. You'd have to be blind. Deep meaning behind scripture, liturgy, my Catholic roots in education. I went to Catholic schools through high school. Always remember things there too. The nuns tell me I was an intellectual delinquent. And they were right. A good Catholic foundation, though we were not practicing Catholics as a family, but really transferred our spiritual life to the mountains. And I don't think that's a cop-out. I suppose it could be. Our sense of community was a family. The sense of oneness with nature and God that comes from the experiences that you have there. And then speaking and listening to God through nature. And listening to God, or to nature, talk to God. There is so much to hear and so little heard by people that travel in wild places. And I'll share a way for you to change that for yourselves, if it's true for yourself. Let me move to another area here that... let me ask you about some of the words we tag on to nature and natural processes. We create goods and bads in nature, do we not? I have an exercise I go through, but we won't go through it this morning because we really don't need to. But how about Bambi, the deer, the beautiful baby deer? And predator. And then we do this exercise, I put up goods and bads. And I always leave a column in the middle, blank, untitled. And I get people to, you know, like yourself, to holler up goods and bads. And somebody, one, the most interesting one to me is that we'll talk about soil. Soil is good. And erosion is bad. Okay? And then we may get campfire or some other natural form fire. Then we get forest fire, and that's bad. And we spend a lot of time and effort and money with Smokey trying to tell you that, when of course it's absurd, and we'll recognize that later. But lots of goods and bads in nature. Well, if we start talking about someone who will usually challenge, and they usually challenge the entry of a forest fire is bad, because now we've got the well-publicized knowledge from Yellowstone and a lot of other experiences. No, wait a minute. Fire isn't bad. Fire is natural, you know. As a matter of fact, it would burn the lodges down over there. It had been really good because I went over there and their housekeeping was so bad they shouldn't have stopped the fire. But anyway, that's not. But, you know, fire, somebody said, well, it's really neutral then. Well, before you're through, everything moves from good and bad to neutral. There's no good and bad in nature, and there's no waste. Early principle of forestry is that, because it was built on utilitarianism, is that the gifts of creation are here for us to use, but use wisely and perpetually. And anything that goes unused is wasted, and waste is a sin. And foresters were taught that. That's Gifford Pinchot. That came right out of Germany and France. And we were taught that a dead tree was a wasted tree. And about halfway through my career, I even believed that. Well, it is an ultimate absurdity. We're going to honor Martin Luther King Monday and through this whole weekend. We'll reflect on this, if you will. I draw a parallel between the lives of humans and the lives of let's say, one of those trees in the ancient forest. I'll comment on that, too. A Douglas fir will live up to 1,000 years. And then it will stand as a dead tree and ultimately overfall and become dead in a windstorm while it's green. It continues to contribute to the ecosystem for a minimum of another 800 years after death. I draw that parallel with Martin. His life was how long? 40 years? Close. Very short life. Think of the contributions he's made after death. That human life, integrated with all nature, follows the same rules. And if our life is good, we continue to make contributions to this world we were blessed to live in. And so the natural rules apply to us. We are the only part of creation that can break them. We've been given the will to do that. And when we do, we can wreak havoc. We can wreak havoc, and we have. But we also then have the skill to fix it. And it seems to be a human trait. We break and we fix. We need to learn not to break. Let's talk about phenomena. Another thing that I love oxymorons. I collect oxymorons. Give me an oxymoron. Give me a good one.
Jumbo shrimp.
Yes. That's great. How about military intelligence? I was a member of the military intelligence. I could use it. Or the one I used to love when I was in the legislation business back in Washington trying to help the Congress get the job done was congressional wisdom. Give me some more.
Fine art of murder.
Yeah.
Independent congregation.
I like that. How about the one that we're hearing from the Middle East? Holy war. Well, I'll give you one I think is, that could be the grand master of all oxymorons, but I'll give you one that I think is better. Natural catastrophe. Think about that. It's again this laden value system that we have, and we classify the Yellowstone fires, natural catastrophe. The San Francisco earthquake, I thought it was urban renewal. But anyway, earthquakes, volcanoes, catastrophes? Hardly. It's interesting when we do our good and bads, we'll get into volcano and somebody will say Crater Lake. And if whether you've been there or seen pictures, you think of that wondrous expanse of just silky smooth, and the Phantom Ship and Wizard Island and that beautiful landscape, and that's good. And Mount St. Helens is usually listed by somebody who lived close to Portland as bad. It's bad. See, Mount St. Helens is the most wondrous place you can go to see the vitality of nature. And so the we have to clean up our act. We have to clean up our language. We have to clean up our value systems if you're really going to accept all this connectedness that the good chief was talking about. If you really are going to practice a little bit of human humility and recognize that these things are wonders. They're wonders. Remember in the Bible that large natural events were used to announce God. And, you know, for us to treat them as catastrophes, sure, that people die and the works of humans and the homes and so on are lost. Those are catastrophes, but the event's not a catastrophe. John Muir expressed this many times and really, really well in this short passage. We'll make the point, and I'll share something that I found that's not it. This one. That he and I had in common, and I didn't even know it. But let me read you this first. This is a great book, by the way. If you want to get good books about ecology, Christian ethics to nature, and all the rest, the best bookstore in America, I think, is in Holden Village. I have the privilege of living in Portland, where there's one square block, three stories high, Powell's Bookstore. A fantastic bookstore. They don't carry volumes I can find here. This is one of them. There's lots to read about Muir, but this is a book using his writings, putting a Christian perspective, baptized into wilderness, about Muir. And Austin says, Muir proposed that we incorporate the history read in nature to our religious experience and memory, as he would lead us to enter a sensuous, trusting relation with wilderness. So he would teach us to honor nature's past and see the great, quote, destructive forces as part of God's loving and creativity. A mile away is a ridge of preglacial lava, the residual mass of fiery floods, and over the meadows, an avalanche of water, rocks, and logs swept a few years ago. The cool lava is forested now. The sun shines lovingly upon it, and all is joyous life. These are nature's modes of working towards beauty and joy. Glacier and volcano bring landscapes, forests, and gardens with their tender lovingness. You all came up here in the boat on Lake Chelan. Lake Chelan is a gift of creation created by an arm of the Continental Glacier that carved that lake basin for us. And of course it was a valley glacier that carved this valley that we're in right now. I've been at the ice margin, as we call it, on those cliffs. Interestingly, as we came up, and you all were all sitting inside, and I was outside one more time enjoying that passage up there and reading the land, the cloud cover was just about at the edge of the ice margin. So if you remember your trip up yesterday, or the day before yesterday, the ice was approximately that deep, and of course it's hundreds of feet below you. That was a solid valley glacier, rolled up and over and down this valley and outletted into the Columbia Basin. And that's pretty spectacular. You can hike up the sides of those cliffs, as I've said, and you'll find the margin where the ice polished rocks and the unpolished rocks join within a centimeter of each other, and you will know the exact edge of that ice margin. And you know, all through these mountains, those things are there for you to perceive and to wonder, to understand, but only if you see them. We've done a lot of really dumb things in the absence of knowledge of human relationships to ecosystems and the integrated relationships within ecosystems. I'll give you a few examples. In my career, fought fires as an enemy. By the way, folks, it's also fun. There's almost nothing more exciting than fighting forest fires. But the very phraseology that we use, fighting forest fires, when in fact now we're setting them in prescribed fires, because we now recognize the absolute essential nature of fire or the need for fire within all of the ecosystems of North America, all of the ecosystems, including Arctic islands. The Indians understood this. We found no place, fire scientists have found no place in the northern hemisphere, north of Panama Canal, where fire is not a part of the ecosystem, someplace in its history. It's really important you store that when we start talking about ancient forests and other things, because we take such a snapshot look, like those slides, a single time look, when in fact we're dealing with eons and the natural influences of eons that we can set aside by our actions. The product of fighting forest fires is the enemy. In those ecosystems that had short burning periods, that is, that burned frequently, just one drainage over in the Eniat, the periodicity of fire is 17 years. Okay, every 17 years in a natural state, the Eniat would burn with ground fires. Very easy to record over there. All you have to do is cut down a big ponderosa pine, and you'll have all of the tree rings and the fire scars at the base of the tree to tell you the history of fire. Well, along comes the Forest Service in 1905 and began to put out those fires, and we got better and better at it, and then we got air forces, and we had all kinds of tools. In 1970, those tools were not enough. In 1970, the Eniat burned in all of Lake Chelan. A total of 285,000 acres went up in 1970, most of them in areas where we had interrupted the natural role of fire and built fuel loading, as we call it, because we had divided and defied a natural principle. Okay, but another important thing about understanding all this and how things are connected is that this drainage, one drainage over, has an entirely different fire history. And if you paid attention on that drive up, despite the fact that you're going to have to fire your bus driver. He said it was a boring trip, boring drive. And it can never be boring. If you really study that far side of the hill, you'll see all the fire history laid out in front of you just like a roadmap. You don't have to be a naturalist or a forester or anything else to see that. All you have to do is recognize patterns, shapes, and sizes. And some of it's man-induced, but most of it's natural. This valley is a valley of large, infrequent fires. The Eniat was a valley of short-term, low-intensity, I should have said high-intensity fires, low-intensity fires in the Eniat. Knowing that and playing by nature's rules and our concern for the long-time existence of this place, knowing the fire is inevitable, it's absolutely inevitable, the 1970s and the 1910s and all those great fire years come with regularity, just as floods do. Knowing that, then we can use nature's rules, and that's why we now set fires. And we can use prescribed fire to fireproof, as it were, this valley in recognition of the existence of Holden. Or take the attitude, well, you just take your chance. See, well, that's where the extra special gifts of creation given to humans come in. We can take natural rules, follow them, emulate them, not break them. That's what we can do. Another example is we set out to preserve the redwoods. How many people have been to the redwoods? Those mystical, wonderful places. Well, you all been there. How would you preserve a redwood? How would you preserve a redwood?
Cut it.
You better believe it. That's exactly right. Cut it. See, if you've been to the redwoods, you've been to the groves. Why are they groves? Why are there frequent stems close to each other and then spaces? Because redwood is a curious conifer. It's the only one that sprouts. You know, birch sprout, aspen sprout. Redwood grows from sprouts, stump sprouts, has very sterile and infrequent cone years, seed years, and can grow from seed, but it more commonly grows from sprouts. Well, what causes it to sprout? It burns down. Or it's covered, in the case of the coast redwoods, by high siltation floods, dies, resprouts. That's how the redwoods got there. It's why they're there. That is their ecosystem. If you go to the redwoods today, where we, and of course we had to remove fires, we're not talking about little brush fires now like the face of the Inia. The only fires that reproduce redwoods are thousands of years apart, huge intensity fires, and killed redwoods, created groves, resprout. That's a natural process. We couldn't live with that because we have cities and human improvements intermingled in that ecosystem. We're not going to take those away. So we have learned that the only way we're going to perpetuate, not preserve, you know, preserve living things. I always like to challenge groups if they want to preserve the ancient forests. I want them to go on a different mission for a while. I want them to preserve ancient foresters. Then I can live forever. And I remember a little old lady here at one of our other hostels said, "I begin to understand you, Busher," she says. "They're living things just like we are." And there's many people that really don't attribute the same living nature to things, to trees, that we do to ourselves, birth and death. An ancient forest is a wonderful and glorious and beautiful place, but it is absolutely more important than a young forest. And they are successively go from one to the other just as we do. So preserving the redwoods will only happen, and of course we won't cut within the park. We cannot create fire within the park. We are creating fire in the High Sierra redwood, the giant sequoia. There we can do it, and we think it may work. But interestingly, the Park Service quit purchasing new tracts of so-called old growth or ancient forests and are purchasing logged over lands, because that's where the young, vibrant redwoods are, so that they will have replacement trees as those 1,000, 2,000-year-old trees drop and new ones form. What's happening in the redwoods? If you go again, go to Lady Bird Johnson's Grove. Lady Bird Johnson was a guest in my lodge on Mount Hood for 2 days, and I got to know her, and then I feed her a lot of wildflower photography over the years. We correspond, and I really like Lady Bird. I told her at dinner that night, to the great distress of the chief of the Forest Service who was sitting with us, that I thought we elected the wrong member of the family, the president. And she said, "I think we did too." But there's a Lady Bird Johnson Grove, and because I just had that chance acquaintance with her, I went to see it with my family and photograph it. I was fascinated because it's on a loop trail. Anybody been there? You have. You take a trail. The Park Service is very clever. They can manipulate human behavior. You have a big wide trail until you get to the juncture of the loop, and then it suddenly necks down and they put a little sign there and it says Lady Bird Johnson Grove. But it's also the return point of the trail, but you don't see that. They focus you, and it's very clever. We use this a lot in nature trails now, because then everybody goes one way, and so you have the least number of encounters and the greatest chance for solitude and seeing trees. So again, you know, people and nature. But I got to Lady Bird Johnson Grove, and I went through a lot of pretty nice sized redwoods. Most impressive trees in that grove are Douglas fir, our old growth Douglas fir. Old growth Douglas fir in the redwood ecosystem is a shade tolerant tree. Or excuse me, Douglas fir, forget old growth. Douglas fir is the replacement tree if no fire comes. Now the exact opposite is true in Oregon and Washington, but in Northern California, tan oak and Doug fir are replacing the redwoods. And they have been for a long time, because the Douglas fir I'm talking about are 600 to 800 years old. And they are the trees. And everybody that goes in there just looks at them as if they're fellow redwoods, but of course they're not. Totally different species, and they're there because they replaced redwoods. So we need to understand. How many people are aware of the CCC program? Inevitably, if they're older people, there's always somebody that was a CCC. Wonderful program. We could use it again. We could use it for our young people. This public service program that our soon-to-be next president talked about, you know, could easily just be another CCC program, and it could be urban and rural and our wild places everywhere. And all young people ought to have the chance to serve and in humankind. And it's a lot better to do than in a military way, though that sometimes is essential. But the CCs were really a wonderful happening. And they created a lot of nature lovers, just kids off the farms in the South and everywhere else that were exposed to an environment they never would have known. But they were caused to do some terribly frustrating things because we didn't understand natural rules. We tried to pull all of the red flowering currant out by the roots in the greater part of the states of Idaho and Montana. Now that was the ambition. And that's what we set those poor young people about doing. Literally grubbing out all the red flowering currant, which is a very common shrub there and grows here. And why were we going to do that? Back to utilitarianism. We believed that it was a fact that the white pine was the most valuable timber tree in that country. Big, beautiful white pine, which also grows in this valley. And it was dying of white pine blister rust. Well, like any rust, it has a co-host. Wheat rust has co-hosts and so on. Blister rust in the pine has a co-host. The co-host, we discovered, was red flowering currant. It would be better if we never found that out. We'd have saved an awful lot of grunting and pulling. So we set about eliminating the host. Therefore, there'd be no more white pine blister rust. Well, of course, we didn't make it. And the white pine's still there. White pine, like all members of the natural community and ourselves, develop resistances, and there are disease-resistant trees, we believe. We have white pine in the valley here with rust, and we have white pine in the valley grown right next to it that doesn't have rust yet. So what are we doing now? What we should have done then. The intelligent thing is to collect seed from the apparent, because you're never sure, the apparent disease-resistant trees, and graft them in a nursery. Garina Nursery outside of Eugene, Oregon, grows white pine blister rust disease-resistant trees, we think. We believe that geneticists tell me six generations of outplantings, and we will be sure. It's about 600 years. But if you don't take the first step, you never make the trip. We tamed the Nile. The Russians helped Egypt greatly. They tamed the Nile with the Aswan Dam, and we destroyed human culture. We created all kinds of liver flukes, human diseases that weren't known. We took one of the most elegant and large ecosystems, the Nile system, and we interrupted it, and it was no blessing. We did many things like that in this country. We created monocultures in our forests. We tried. It was our objective when I started in forestry in the Northwest. Our objective was to pack every acre with as many Doug fir as could grow there, because that was a money tree on the west side. And that's when we saw the forest as a tree farm. Mr. Weyerhaeuser has a right to see a forest as a tree farm, because Chief Seattle would argue, but he owns it. And that is his objective. That is not a legitimate objective for your lands, the national forest. It's an illegitimate objective because it does not see the forest for the trees. And like so many old phrases, that one's very accurate. We didn't see the forest for the trees. The forest is all those things you saw up there and more. So, by the way, we weren't successful because nature is also a really dandy tree planter. And all of those places that I had my 60-person crew planting trees grew a lot of wonderful Doug fir, but there's about a 30% component of alder and hemlock and a little bit of cedar. And everyone, I've revisited all those plantations. Some have been logged in my career. Some of my plantations have been logged for the first time. So this thing goes on and on and on. Extremely productive ground, but nature has helped us along just fine, thank you. And is that important? Sure, it's important, because there's a spreading root rot through Douglas fir that wouldn't be spreading if we had let the land go through an alder cycle, because alder will not be a host and it will die out in the soil. If you keep continuous plantation of Douglas fir, you eventually will not be able to grow Douglas fir to a mature age. I talked about, I made the comparison of the Reverend Martin Luther King and ancient forest tree. How little we knew when we thought that dead trees were wasted trees. Because the contributions that they make on the forest floor are essential to the survival of the forest. Another thing we do is we place value systems on single elements of an ecosystem. You saw two of them up there, those. I even heard the reaction to the slide, the two cuddly spotted owls, those two darling, sweet little creatures that's so easy to put our arms around, the cuddly. Well, let me tell you that if there was any legitimacy in an effort to save the spotted owls, there is much greater legitimacy in saving the common earwig. But it's real tough to cuddle a earwig. The common earwig makes a much greater contribution to a Douglas fir, old growth forest, an essential contribution. The skeletal remains of an earwig are the breeding ground for mycorrhizae, a fungi which is essential to making nutrients, especially nitrogen, usable to the tree. The spotted owl is a predator for the voles and the mice, as well as flying squirrels, but especially the moles and mice that are the transport mechanism for the mycorrhizae fungi. So in that sense, if the spotted owl didn't have predators, it'd be a damn nuisance in an old growth forest. In fact, it's not. It has its place too. Its contribution is not as great. And the forest can do just fine without it, and probably will have to, because the barred owl has moved south from Canada, and that spotted owl is just as timid as it looks on that branch, and it's very tame. I can bring spotted owls now in many places in the West by slamming the door on a green pickup. That's all it takes anymore. We're out there calling those constantly, required by law, and locating and tagging. I just found out from the forest supervisor this forest, Sonny O'Neill, he and I met day before yesterday in the morning to talk about how things are going. And they now have 500 tagged pair of spotted owls on the Wenatchee National Forest. That's the one we've caught and tagged. The reason you can bring them by slamming the door on a Forest Service pickup is because we go out there and we got all these wonderful young people all summer long calling the owls and taking mice and feeding the mice. And that's why you get all these pictures. All the pictures you see in TV and all the rest of that they just came to get dinner. And they become so anticipatory of everybody that gets out of a green pickup having mice, it's really not difficult to locate spotted owls anymore. We've conditioned them. And in fact, they get downright unruly when they don't get a mouse. But they have their predators too. So spotted owls are wonderful. Old trees are wonderful. Young trees are wonderful, and so is the common earwig. All things are co-equal. Some have more importance than others. What time we go to coffee? Good. Oh. Okay, yeah, a little before. Good, and we got time to quit listening to me and talk with each other. Who would like to volunteer? Remember I urged you yesterday when we first got acquainted that you really have to be forthcoming. See, with Elder Hassel, which I also do here, that's no problem. Old people are wonderful, see. They're all over worrying about how they sound or whether they make a mistake or any of the rest. I'm now 59, so I'm very close to being eligible. And so, you know, and when we're younger, we're worried we may see something foolish or, you know, don't do that. Be childlike throughout all of this. Go back to when things were full of wonder and wonderful. And expose yourselves to each other and share. Because what we have to share is the greatest gift we can give to each other. Who really has had a wilderness experience, and most particularly maybe one that wasn't in my classic wilderness that I've been privileged to live in, but wilderness anywhere, wild place anywhere, that has had real meaning in their life, maybe changed their life, yes?
I was born and raised in Holland, and as a child, my wilderness experience would be in the parks around us. I remember the odor of the flowers and a blue jay that would try to attack us or something like that, and climbing the hills and so forth. That would be, in that sense, as a child, a wilderness experience. Another one would be standing on the side of a hill and watching rain come. I recall watching this heavy dark cloud at a distance, and it just seemed to turn over. I always remember it like it turned over like a cup. Someone just poured a cup on and just started raining. I never forgotten that scene.
Bless you, because that reminded me of something that I didn't share that's so terribly important. I'll go back to my family again, and it has to do with weather, and I didn't talk about weather. The very best weather for me is violent weather, dramatic weather. All those years that we spent in the mountains together, I had to reverse the influence of the grandmothers in the rest of society, which plans its life by the weather. You know, what foolishness. And, oh, it's a gray day. I hate that phrase. It's a gray day. I don't think we'll go out today. Or it's going to rain. Okay? And of course, what a wonderful blessing, a rainstorm. What a drama. Mm-hmm. And in Harlem or in Oregon, it makes no difference. And so I kept pounding away at my children and coaching, not teaching. Coaching's better than teaching. And so we were in a supermarket, Safeway in Bellingham, Washington, when I was doing the North Cascade study, and I was one of my 4 days at home and then 10 days out for 9 months running. So I was really glad to be home, and I was with my little boy, and we were shopping. We got up to the cash register, and a real nice matronly lady there is pounding the keys, and the weather outside was frightful. It was holding the heavy doors of the Safeway store open, literally, and we're talking horizontal rain. And so the inevitable happens, and this lady at the cash register looks down at my little boy, and she says, "Well, son," she says, "this sure is terrible weather, isn't it?" And he looked up at her with that wonderful innocence of youth and said, "Oh, no, ma'am, all weather's good. Some just better than others." And the result of my coaching. Of course, she looked at me and said, "Gee, it's really too bad you got a retarded child." But it has affected their lives, and certainly mine, to break that terrible, terrible fiction that we place on ourselves and constrain ourselves with, that in some way weather should influence our behavior. It is absolutely absurd. The most wonderful thing in the world is to work in a forest when it's pouring rain, because the smells, which you talked about, are so acute then. The brush doesn't slap. Brush doesn't sting in the rain. I know, I made my early career in the Oregon coast, and that's as close as we've got to a jungle. And it's much friendlier in the wet than it is in the dry. And so, but the dry is nice too. And the fall is so fabulous because as things begin to decay, the odors are particularly memorable. But weather, you know, is such an absolute integrated part of our lives. Why would we make it desirable and undesirable by our value systems? You got to work to overcome that though, because you really think, I mean, you hear it every day on the news. Every day, you know, oh, it's going to be bad weather's coming. Look at the results of the bad weather around us here. Very important. What else? What other experiences that you might want to share?
I don't know if you count this as a wilderness experience, but it's an experience with nature. I used to live in a city that had very often very violent electrical storms. And our house sat up on a hill. We could look down and we'd observe them there. I mean, it went here, went there, boom, boom, boom. And finally, it got us one day. It hit our house. And I thought that was really great.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I said that I had something in common with Mirror, and I didn't know it until I started reading Mirror much later than the event in my life. But I was up here in the North Cascades and was high on the ridges. There are no trails in the North Cascades on the ridges, by the way, contrary to the, you know, there are around here. But as soon as you get up north, it's really wild country. And the only trails were built by miners, and they're all up the bottoms because that's where the ore was. And so I was freelancing it across the mountaintops and the ridges and being careful because I was alone. And a storm was rolling in, same thing you talked about, and this is all maritime weather, and so if you're high in the mountains, you can always see it coming, and nature always sends a telegraph message to let you know. What is that telegraph message? How many people here from the Northwest? What's the nature's telegraph message to let you know if rainstorms are coming?
Wind?
You'll see a picture later.
Please turn here.
Wind is a factor, but it's visual. It's visual before the wind ever gets to its clouds. And it's a specific cloud. It's lenticular altocumulus, and they perch on the tops of our volcanoes. And if you really examine that lengthy phrase, it's very simple. It's lens-shaped, lenticular. Altocumulus are high cumulus clouds. And so every mountaintop will send you a flag. I mean, the weather will be as clear as it is now, but you'll know within 12 hours you're going to have a weather change. Well, I knew it was coming for about the first 10 hours of the day, and so started to think about where I was going to camp. I was going to get off the bridge and do the smart thing and find a secure camp down at mid-slope. And decided, no, I don't think I really want to do that. I'd like to experience a storm. I'd like to experience it in a tree. And so instead of camping that night, I found myself an old gnarled Doug fir that reached out over the canyon and very top of the ridge, and it had lots of branches from all the wind shaping, and I found myself a little cranny and nook and hooked up in there and put a carabiner and a line around myself so I wouldn't get blown out, and I wouldn't have mind dying there, but it was earlier than I planned, and and so I stayed through the storm in that tree, and if the sounds and the feel and the sensing. Well, Mirror did this very same thing, and unbeknownst to me until I, as I said, read his readings, and there's just a wonderful article in one of the books up here with Mirror about his night in the tree, and he tells the story better than I do. But only then do you begin to truly realize the living nature of a tree. Because they don't move around like the animals, we do tend to forget that they are living. And that they do grow and change and die. And when you spend a night in one in a howling maritime storm and rain and wind, you begin to feel the pulse and to hear the strains and the sounds and to feel the strength and the security. I never felt insecure. Never felt insecure, but I didn't pick a weak tree either. What else?
Climbing Mount Baker and sleeping on the glacier at night and getting up 2 in the morning and it's dark out and starting your ascent and then getting to the bottom. It's a beautiful day and sun, and just in a matter of minutes the storm comes sometimes. It's just pure whiteout through the last climb. And not ever having done it, I was people who knew what they were doing, but it was all by feel and trust in the people for your breath and trust in yourself, and it was just absolutely incredible. It was just so disoriented and climbing up the ice to the very top. And,
it's really important.
The weather and building an ice cave because you had the snow cave.
Because what you're sharing with us is that your experience was enhanced by the weather. Not diminished. See, and of course that just again flies into our rhetoric of the influence of weathers. But you're right. Virtually any tenderfoot, I was going to say fool, but I forget, I got to be a good Christian. Any tenderfoot can get along in these mountains for a while in what we call good weather. The real challenge is, you know, it may be discomfortable when they get, you know, blistered and all the other funny things that happen to people that don't know how to get along, but they're not in jeopardy. Only are you challenged, and only do your skills get tested when the weather changes. My family and I have been snowed on every month of the year in the Cascade Range. Every month of the year. And every time it's happened, it enhances, just as you described. But how about, does anybody have anything to share that in truth was a spiritual experience? And in fact, they truly felt closer to the Creator, either they sought it, as I'm going to try to share with you on a technique to do that, or it happened, that you had what you would truly describe as a spiritual experience.
Well, when I was 14, I grew up in a small town of 500 in eastern Washington, and I was walking home, and it's always really dark and quiet, and it was around 9:30 at night, and I looked up at the stars, and I suddenly felt a really warm presence fill me, and I felt really close to God, and I told my friend Jeff, I said, I feel like I've been touched by the Holy Spirit. And so I went and talked to my pastor. We went forward to be baptized. My friend Jeff had this feeling come over him too. But I always remember, it was really cold and it was snowy, and I was feeling really in tune with that because I liked the snow, and I was walking and it was very crisp and crunching. It was squeaking. It was squeaking cold.
Isn't that a wonderful sound?
Yeah.
I heard it this morning on my skis. How many people slept past 5:30?
Oh.
And you call yourself Christians. The Lord was very present in this valley this morning. I skied out at about 5:30, I guess. I finally got out of the shower and and I headed up the valley, and there's a crescent, of course, crystal clear, and there's a crescent moon low on the horizon, and you could see it the minute I hit the trail just before the road dives off and crosses the bridge to the mine. I saw the glow on the snow in front of me as if there were a large spotlight. I had already seen all the high country above us, and the mountains at the head of the valley were illuminated from just that crescent moon. Because it's so crystal clear, because immediately after storms is the clearest air you ever get. It's been truly cleansed. And the power of that little sliver to reflect the sun is so fantastic in the snowscape up here. And, you know, you want a spiritual experience, all you had to do is pass into that little spot on the trail of moonlight that reached the valley. When I came back, that was much larger, and it had moved because it was in the full of the V notch in the mountains back here in Copper Basin. But to be up here and to be in bed at that time is a foolishness, folks. Oh, it was just exhilarating. Just exhilarating. Yes.
Living up here, I don't get up at 5:00 in the morning. I don't think I could be touched at 5:00.
Oh, come on.
But every time I leave my house, be it 8 in the morning, noon, or 3 or 9 at night, I'm always amazed at how different it looks.
Yeah. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yes.
The sun, the moon, no sun, the stars, the clouds, the fog. It's just...
See, that perception is so important, and we're really going to go into that after the coffee hour, on how we do perceive. But to eliminate that notion that things are static, and to understand that every mood has its own particular beauty, and they're always new. You're right. You'll say, well, this is like that foggy day 3 weeks ago. And it's not. It's not. All things change. I'll dramatically demonstrate that to you in a personal way. You can't go back in nature and expect to find what you saw before, because I will guarantee you it will have changed sooner or later. No matter, including glaciers.
Something else that's very awesome is the silence. mean, even if you're walking down the road and then just stop in the silence, or if you stoke at 3 in the morning and come out in the silence, that's really neat. That's what I'm saying.
Come with the power go though.
We'll talk some about that.
I mean, you can hear sounds.
Yeah.
It's a silence, but...
I know what you're saying. See, that's also kind of conventional wisdom, though, because I'm going to teach you to listen. See, this morning I did just that. I stopped in that shaft of moonlight, partly because I was carrying more weight than I used to, and I need a little blow. But I stopped to feel it and to listen, and it's the point at which the river's closest. And so the dominant sound, and it's a lyric sound, it was a river, and I thought that was all I would hear. And I said, "Well, sure, come on, get a hold of yourself. You know better than that." And so I stayed and listened longer. And I was rewarded with the call of a coyote from far, far down in the valley. And there is a lot to hear, but yes, of course, it's silence relative to the rest of our life and the places we spend it. But there is much to hear and to interpret. How many people here, and it's sure okay to disagree, because for a long time, we did scientifically and cynically disagree. How many believe that there are healing effects from wild places, from exposure to wild places? How many believe that's a little silly? Let me take you through three passages which are interesting. William O. Douglas, the justice, was raised, of course, in Yakima, and he lived in the mountains that I studied for wilderness, both the Goat Rocks editions and Norse Peak and the Cougar Lakes country. And the Cougar Lakes was what was to be the Cougar Lakes Wilderness, was created just as the justice died. And I had met with him as I started this study process down there, because there's probably no human alive that knew the country better than he did. And we had a short time to talk, 2 hours. The only time I ever saw him alive. And he was very obviously supporting and encouraging in a long dream that his boyhood playpen in the mountains would become wilderness. And so I have more memorabilia in my Forest Service Museum in my den than you can believe. But one of the most treasured things I have is literally a note from Justice Douglas from his deathbed, and which he responded. We had our study out for public response, and he wrote to me personally in a scribbled handwriting, a one-page note that said, "We'd got it just right." And that was to the great dismay of my environmental community friends, who were trying to always, whatever I thought was right had to be bigger. And because I represented the government, and government solutions always imperfect. And Justice Douglas really satisfied me, because actually I made almost every acre out there that was eligible under the criteria of wilderness, so it was not hard to make it right. So I caused started the initiative that got Cougar Lakes named after the justice, even though the Forest Service does not like to name wilderness after people. And so I had that special tie with the justice. So I read a lot of his material, and some's pretty good reading and some's not. He wrote this in an interesting book, not so well known, A Wilderness Bill of Rights. If you remember, the justice was campaigning for the legal standing of animals, okay? And he was also campaigning for the legal standing of nature. And he wrote these words, 1965. "The healing effects of wilderness are well known. Cares slough off. The conscious and unconscious springs that create tension are relaxed. Man comes to an understanding of his relation to the earth from which he came and to which he returns." Well, and he goes on. Let me think. He says, Wordsworth, Thoreau, Muir, Leopold, Meary, each express the healing effects of the wildness of nature, and together they constitute an illustrious list of witnesses in its favor. Well, I'm a member of the American Forestry Association. Are any of you? get American Forest Magazine. It's not a professional organization, it's a lay people's organization. Very good magazine. There was a book review of this book in 1965 by Monroe Bush, one of the editors of a Wilderness Bill of Rights. And he was quite complimentary to the prose and the writing, except this, that particular passage I just read you. And Monroe Bush, in his critique, said, "However, I must confess to questioning the sentimental theses that wilderness is a therapist, etc. Men are social, gregarious creatures. Wilderness is great. That is, wilderness is fun. But please, it's no religion." Well, I think, you know, that's no put down to Monroe Bush at all. I think that was a contemporary view at the time. You know, he was a very well-educated man. That's how he felt. And he was pretty cynical about this therapeutic value that nature would have for us. In 1986, there's a lot of writing now, but one in particular, 1986, a medical opinion by a recognized expert in his field in 1986, natural vegetation can influence people's moods, contribute to stress reduction, and promote medical recovery. Dr. Ulrich. And it's well established now. Trees in the cities, your wild places. Trees in the cities are far more valuable, I believe, to humankind than trees in the forest. Solely because they are either there, Central Park, because we kept them, or because we planted them.